Welcome to the deep dive. I'm just so glad you could join us today because we are getting into something that fundamentally shapes your daily life.
Even if you rarely see the actual gears turning in the background.
Right. We are going to start right out of the gate with a question that feels intentionally provocative. I want you to really think about this for a second. Is the invention of money a form of violence?
It is, it's a really heavy question to open with.
It is.
And it serves as the foundational inquiry of the source material we're pulling apart today. It immediately forces you to look at something completely mundane, like the cash in your physical wallet or the digital number sitting in your banking app, and ask what kind of hidden coercive force it actually wields across society.
And our mission for this deep dive is to unpack a fascinating 2026 white paper that attempts to answer that exact question. It's titled Life First: Monetary Architecture, Structural Violence, and the Case for Viability Budgeting.
Which is quite the title.
It is. Now, before we get into the heavy macroeconomic concepts, the authorship of this paper is incredibly unique. This was co-authored by Dr. Bichara Sawhili, who is a physician and a systems thinker with decades of clinical experience in the Caribbean. But its co-author is actually ChatGPT 5.2.
Yes, an advanced artificial intelligence acting as what the paper calls a systems integrator.
Which creates such a compelling intellectual partnership, right?
Absolutely. On one hand, you have the deep lived expertise of a medical doctor. This is someone who understands biological systems, public health, and the very real human consequences of economic policies when they actually hit the clinic floor.
The biological reality on the ground.
Exactly. And then you pair that ground level biological reality with the massive pattern recognition capabilities of an AI to tackle global macroeconomics. It's a brilliant way to synthesize human clinical observation with computational scale.
And if you happen to be watching our video feed right now, you'll notice our backdrop has changed to a very specific cityscape. It's drawn straight from the central visual provided in the white paper itself.
I love this visual.
Yeah, can you walk us through what we're looking at here?
Sure. So imagine a city built on layered, tiered foundations, almost like a massive illuminated step pyramid. The very bottom layer, anchored deep in the earth, is glowing with this foundational energy. That layer is labeled water and infrastructure.
Okay, water and infrastructure at the base.
Right. Resting directly on top of that glowing foundation is a second distinct layer called social stability.
Which makes sense. You need the infrastructure to keep things stable.
Precisely. And then finally, resting on top of social stability, you have the very top layer, which is essential services, and the bustling, visible city itself. The markets, the culture, the day-to-day economy.
The stuff we interact with every day.
The entire argument of the paper we're exploring today is captured in this single image. Sequencing matters.
Sequencing matters.
You simply cannot build a stable city or a stable society if the foundational layer of basic infrastructure is crumbling.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the core theory of this paper is that our current global economic system gets this exact sequence completely disastrously backward.
We're trying to build the glittering city at the top first.
Exactly. We build the top and we're just crossing our fingers and hoping we have enough leftover cash at the end of the fiscal year to reinforce the foundation. And when we inevitably don't, that is where the violence enters the equation.
To understand how a municipal budget or a national fiscal policy can actually be violent, the paper draws heavily on the work of the sociologist Johann Galtung.
From the 1960s, right?
Yes. Back in the 60s, Galtung developed a framework outlining three distinct types of violence: direct, structural, and cultural. The white paper takes Galtung's framework and overlays it onto our modern monetary system to demonstrate exactly how the architecture of money enacts physical harm.
Let's walk through these three types, because looking at money through this lens completely shifted my perspective. Let's start with direct violence. This is the one we usually think of when we hear the word violence.
Right. Direct violence is visible. It has a clear subject and a clear object. Someone is doing the harming and someone is being harmed.
But in an economic context, we aren't talking about a physical punch.
No, it looks like predatory lending practices that intentionally trap vulnerable people in compounding debt traps. It looks like forced labor conditions. Or, to bring it to a very common reality, it's the physical act of a family being evicted from their home because they missed a rent payment.
Wow, okay.
It is the immediate observable harm inflicted on individuals by an economic system that prioritizes the enforcement of debt contracts over basic human dignity.
It's the sharp end of the spear.
Yeah.
It's the stuff you can catch on a smartphone camera and point to and say, that is wrong.
Yeah.
But then we get to the second layer, which is structural violence. And the paper argues this is built directly into the very code of the system. This is the invisible violence.
It is invisible, but its scale is vastly larger than direct violence. Structural violence occurs when the rules, institutions, and algorithms of the economic system systematically disadvantage certain groups or prioritize financial optics over human survival.
So there's no single person pulling a trigger.
Exactly. Think about severe austerity measures implemented by a sovereign government. When a government decides to slash funding for public health clinics or delay maintenance on a municipal water sanitation plant just to meet an arbitrary deficit target, the resulting suffering is profound.
The preventable diseases, the shortened lifespans, the chronic stress.
Yes, that is structural violence. It's developing nations that find themselves trapped in endless compounding cycles of sovereign debt. They are forced to export their real, tangible natural resources, minerals, agriculture, energy, just to acquire the foreign currency needed to pay the interest on historical loans.
Leaving their own domestic populations without basic necessities.
Precisely. No single banker is explicitly walking into a village and causing harm, but the architecture of the international lending system is causing predictable, statistical devastation.
It really makes you rethink the everyday language we use around economics.
Yeah.
I want you to think about how often you hear terms like living within our means or tightening our belts applied to national governments during political debates.
It's a very common refrain.
We routinely hear politicians talk about the national budget as if it were a household checkbook. And as a culture, we accept that narrative. It sounds responsible. But that narrative perfectly justifies the structural cuts to things like public schools, disaster preparedness, or rural hospitals.
We nod along and say, well, money just isn't there as a vital hospital wing shuts its doors.
Which brings us to the crucial third layer of Galtung's framework, cultural violence.
Cultural violence is the ideological narrative that legitimizes both the direct and the structural violence. It is the stories we tell ourselves, the economic myths we pass down to make the suffering seem natural, inevitable, or even morally necessary.
The paper highlights some pretty brutal examples of this cultural narrative in action. The myth of the deserving poor is a massive one.
It's deeply ingrained.
This pervasive idea that if you are struggling economically, it is ultimately a personal moral failing. You didn't work hard enough, or you made bad choices. It completely obscures the systemic flaws in the structural violence we've just talked about.
Or the deeply ingrained belief that extreme scarcity is just the natural default state of the world. So, of course, there will be massive numbers of winners and losers in the brutal arena of market competition.
It's just framed as the law of the jungle.
When a society internalizes the idea that poverty is essentially a character flaw, it becomes completely acceptable, even righteous, to deny basic life-saving services to vulnerable populations. Cultural violence does the heavy lifting of making invisible structural violence feel like justice.
It rationalizes the inequality so we don't have to confront the cruelty of the system. This was a massive paradigm shift for me while reading the source material. The fundamental idea that money itself, the actual concept of a medium of exchange or a unit of account, isn't inherently violent.
It's just a coordination tool, a ledger.
Exactly.
Okay.
But a monetary system explicitly designed around artificial scarcity is deeply violent.
What's fascinating here is that our current system enforces competition at the absolute baseline level of human survival. When your basic access to clean drinking water, caloric intake, and a roof over your head is entirely conditional on your daily success in a highly volatile, unpredictable labor market, it creates an ambient, constant level of societal threat.
You're never truly safe.
No. Chronic stress becomes the baseline neurological state for millions of people.
But wait, I have to play devil's advocate for a second here. If money is just a tool, a way to distribute resources, why does it feel like such an inescapable trap? If we have the resources, why do we constantly feel like we are bumping up against these invisible, impenetrable walls that say we can't afford it?
The authors argue this comes down to a fundamental society-wide misunderstanding of the concept of constraints. This takes us to the absolute core problem identified in the white paper. We confuse the map for the territory.
The map and the territory, okay.
The paper makes a critical structural distinction between two very different things. Real constraints and artificial constraints. Mixing these two up is where the architecture of our economy begins to actively degrade biological life.
Let's define these clearly. A real constraint is a biophysical limit, right? It's the laws of physics, biology, thermodynamics, ecology.
Exactly. A real constraint is the physical capacity of skilled labor in a given region. It's the availability of raw materials like steel, concrete, and lumber. It is energy limits, the yield of an acre of topsoil, and ecological boundaries like the carbon absorption capacity of the atmosphere.
Basically, no matter how much money a government prints or borrows, money cannot magically conjure a seasoned vascular surgeon if no one has actually gone through medical school.
Right. If you don't have the physical concrete and the excavators, you cannot build the bridge, even if your municipal bank account has billions of dollars sitting in it.
Those are hard, immutable limits. You cannot negotiate with physics.
But then you have artificial constraints. These are human-made institutional rules, accounting conventions, debt ceilings, deficit to GDP targets, arbitrary fiscal policy ratios established by treaties or legislation.
The rules we made up.
These are purely symbolic constraints that we have invented to manage the economy and attempt to control inflation.
And here is the tragedy that the paper outlines so clearly. Here's where it gets really interesting. I want to dive into this diagnostic flowchart they included in Appendix A because it's incredibly revealing.
The water pipe scenario.
Yes. I want you to picture this scenario. Imagine a mid-sized town. The municipal water pipes are aging, corroding, and leaking. The water pressure is dropping, and the water itself is flirting with becoming biologically unsafe to drink.
A physical crisis.
A real crisis. Now, in the same town, there are dozens of skilled construction workers and plumbers who are currently unemployed and actively looking for work. The concrete, the PVC pipes, the heavy machinery, it is all sitting idle in a local warehouse ready to be deployed.
The labor is there, the materials are there.
The dire physical need is there. But the project is completely halted. Why? Because the town council looks at a spreadsheet and says, there is no money. They have hit a municipal debt ceiling.
That specific scenario is the diagnostic test for our entire economic system. You have to ask, is the constraint halting this life-saving work physical, or is it rule-based?
In that example, the real biophysical constraints are easily met.
The human labor exists. The physical materials exist. The roadblock is an artificial constraint, an accounting rule, that is actively, aggressively overriding physical reality. We are treating a symbolic rule on a spreadsheet as if it were an immutable law of physics, like gravity.
We are literally letting symbolic math degrade our biological life support systems. We will allow a community to drink contaminated water, risking long-term neurological damage to children, to ensure a municipal ledger balances, according to a rule that a city council made up 20 years ago.
It sounds absurd when you lay it out like that.
It is absurd.
And the paper dives deeply into the psychological toll of living under this manufactured absurdity. They cite a wealth of behavioral science research demonstrating how perceived scarcity fundamentally alters human cognition.
It changes how our brains work.
Yes. When individuals or entire communities live under constant economic insecurity, when they are constantly told there isn't enough for basic survival, it literally narrows their cognitive bandwidth.
You lose the ability to engage in long-term planning because all of your mental energy is fiercely consumed by short-term survival calculations.
Your brain is trapped in a loop of, how do I pay rent this Friday? How do I afford groceries this afternoon? What happens if my car breaks down tomorrow?
It's exhausting.
This chronic low-grade terror fractures social cohesion. It erodes community trust, and it makes societies highly susceptible to extreme political polarization and scapegoating. We lose our capacity for stewardship and become entirely reactive.
But surely the counter-argument here is about inflation, right?
Right.
If a government just ignores the accounting rules and says, we have the workers, we have the pipes, let's just fund the water project unconditionally, doesn't traditional macroeconomic theory tell us that bypassing those fiscal constraints is a one-way ticket to hyperinflation?
We can't just pretend accounting rules don't serve a purpose.
Right.
That is the standard friction point in this debate, and the paper addresses it head-on. The authors do not argue that money is infinite or that inflation isn't a threat. What they argue is that inflation is a symptom of hitting a real constraint, not an artificial one.
Okay, unpack that for me.
If a government tries to build 10 hospitals, but there is only enough steel and labor in the country to build 3, pumping more money into the system won't build more hospitals. It will just cause the price of steel and labor to skyrocket.
Because you hit a hard physical wall.
That is inflation caused by hitting a biophysical limit. But in the town water pipe example, the labor and materials were sitting idle. Employing idle resources to fix essential infrastructure does not inherently cause inflation. It absorbs unused capacity to secure societal stability.
So the accounting rule is blinding us to our actual physical capacity.
Exactly.
So we have this grim reality where artificial constraints are causing structural violence, narrowing our cognitive bandwidth, and actively degrading the infrastructure we need to survive. If the current sequence is backwards, if we are consistently putting the accounting rules before the biological reality, how do we actually fix the order?
Dr. Saley and ChatGPT 5.2 propose a comprehensive framework they call viability budgeting. And the core mechanism, the beating heart of this framework, is establishing what they define as the viability floor.
Before we define the floor, let's quickly review how traditional budgeting works, just to see the contrast clearly.
In traditional municipal or national budgeting, a government always starts by looking at revenue projections. They look at tax receipts, their self-imposed debt limits, and their deficit targets. They calculate their total available fiscal space.
The size of the pie.
Then, whatever pool of money is allowed within those artificial constraints is divided up among all the competing departments, including the essential life support services like public health, water sanitation, and emergency response. If revenue suddenly drops due to a recession or the debt ceiling looms, everything across the board gets cut.
You are forcing biological life to fit into the arbitrary boundaries of the budget.
Precisely. Viability budgeting completely, radically reverses this sequence. The mantra is life first, accounting second.
Life first, accounting second.
In this model, a society must first define the absolute minimum physical conditions required for that society to survive, remain biologically viable, and maintain social stability. This baseline is the viability floor.
And then what?
You calculate the cost of maintaining that floor, and you fund it unconditionally, regardless of the broader macroeconomic weather. Only after the life support systems are fully secured do you take whatever resources and labor capacity are left over and optimize your financial ratios, service your external debt, and fund discretionary spending.
It sounds so intuitive. The paper explicitly lists out 7 core viability categories that make up this floor. And when you hear them, it is incredibly obvious that these are not luxuries. They are the prerequisites for civilization.
They absolutely are.
Let's list them. 1, water and sanitation. 2, healthcare and public health. 3, food security. 4, shelter and housing stability. 5, education and skills development. 6, energy and critical infrastructure. And 7, public safety and disaster preparedness.
Every single one of those 7 categories is a non-negotiable precondition for societal continuity. If any one of those pillars fundamentally fails, the society destabilizes rapidly.
It doesn't matter how well the stock market is doing.
You can have a booming stock market, but if the water sanitation grid collapses, your city falls into chaos within 72 hours. Viability budgeting dictates that these specific sectors must be funded first, they must be legally protected from austerity during economic downturns, and they must be aggressively strengthened during economic expansions.
I find the inclusion of education interesting here. Water, food, healthcare, those are obvious biological needs, but education as a viability floor requirement.
In a modern, complex society, education is a survival mechanism. If you do not maintain a pipeline of skilled labor engineers to run the power grid, nurses to staff the clinics, agronomists to manage food production, your society loses its biophysical capacity to maintain the other 6 pillars.
Oh, I see.
Education is the long-term maintenance of human capital. Without it, the viability floor inevitably collapses a generation later.
Let's bring this down from the abstract macroeconomic theory and look at a very specific local example provided in Section 5 of the text. Let's return to the municipal water utility. Under a traditional austerity budget, if the town faces an unexpected budget shortfall, maybe a major factory closed down and tax revenues dipped, what happens?
The town council looks for places to cut.
And preventative maintenance is almost always the first thing on the chopping block because it's invisible.
It is the easiest thing to cut politically.
Exactly. So they defer the corrosion control budget for the water treatment plant. They postpone upgrading the aging lead pipes. It saves the town a few million dollars on paper this fiscal year. The spreadsheet balances. The mayor looks fiscally responsible.
But the physical reality is very different.
Chemically, the pipes begin to degrade. lead slowly leaches into the drinking water, and a massive public health crisis explodes 5 or 10 years later, resulting in irreversible neurological damage to a generation of children, costing the state exponentially more money in special education and healthcare, and completely ruining lives.
But under a viability budgeting framework, that specific corrosion control maintenance is legally cordoned off and protected. The viability floor mandates that infrastructure maintenance funding cannot be cut below scientifically determined safety thresholds, regardless of the fiscal climate.
You don't mess with the floor.
You do not balance the budget by borrowing against the biological safety of the citizens. The pipe is fixed first, period. Because a functioning safe water system is, as the paper brilliantly calls it, peace infrastructure.
Peace infrastructure. I absolutely love that term. Because we don't usually equate plumbing with peace. But when the taps run dry or poison the citizens, peace evaporates instantly. The paper uses another great example analyzing the healthcare clinic.
The primary healthcare clinic is a perfect illustration of sequencing. Under traditional austerity models, clinic budgets are constantly squeezed to find efficiencies. Staffing ratios are reduced to the bare minimum. Preventive care outreach drops off.
And we know how that plays out in the real world.
People delay getting minor ailments checked out. Small, highly localized, easily treatable outbreaks of disease are missed by the understaffed clinic. Those small outbreaks then explode into massive, system-wide health crises that end up requiring incredibly expensive emergency interventions, ICU beds, and broad economic shutdowns.
You save a dollar on a nurse's salary and spend $1,000 on an ICU bed a month later.
In a viability framework, primary care is viewed fundamentally as a shock absorber for the broader economy. You fiercely protect the clinic staffing ratios. You ensure the essential medicine inventory is always buffered with a surplus.
You build slack into the system.
By guaranteeing that stability at the local clinic level, you identify and neutralize threats early, preventing the massive, catastrophic, downstream systemic shocks that bankrupt governments.
It's easy to hear terms like unconditional funding for food, shelter, and health, and assume this is a pure, radical, anti-capitalist manifesto advocating for the total abolition of the free market. We are so conditioned to associate these basic needs with market commodities.
Yeah.
But the paper actually draws a very distinct line here.
It does.
It goes out of its way to explicitly state that this framework is not about eliminating markets. Markets and innovation absolutely continue.
Yes, they do. Competitive markets, private enterprise, and risk-taking operate above the viability floor. People can still start businesses, innovate, invest capital, and create massive wealth.
So what's the shift?
The fundamental shift is that biological survival is no longer conditional on market success. If you take a risk, start a business, and it completely fails, you might lose your invested assets, you might lose your business, but you will not lose your access to clean drinking water, primary health care, or basic caloric security. Your dignity and your biological survival are guaranteed by the baseline architecture of the system.
That distinction is transformative. It completely removes the existential terror from economic participation. You can participate in the market without the ambient threat of destitution hanging over your head.
Survival is no longer conditional on market success. That distinction is transformative.
So what actually happens to a society that implements this protected floor versus one that doesn't? The paper maps this out beautifully as the tale of two cycles.
They map out the macroeconomic consequences of these sequencing choices, boiling it down to a divergence between the fragility cycle and the stability cycle.
Let's start with fragility.
If a society treats survival goods as discretionary line items to be cut when the math gets tight, they inevitably enter the fragility cycle. Let's trace it step by step.
Let's do it.
An external economic shock hits the nation, say, a global pandemic or a massive spike in energy prices. The government's immediate response, dictated by traditional artificial constraints, is austerity to balance the books and appease bondholders.
Cut spending.
This austerity causes the immediate degradation of essential services. The water mains break more often, the clinics close, the power grid experiences rolling blackouts. This physical degradation leads directly and rapidly to intense social stress and profound public anger.
People can only take so much pressure before the social contract breaks.
Exactly. That intense stress boils over into civil unrest, strikes, and protests. The state then responds to the unrest not by fixing the water, but with repression. Increased police budgets, enforcement, crackdowns.
Which makes things worse.
This creates massive societal volatility. And what do global investors hate more than anything? Volatility. So this instability spooks foreign and domestic investors, leading to massive capital flight.
Money leaves the country.
The capital flight destroys the economy's tax base and currency value further, which leads the government to enforce deeper austerity. It is a perfect self-reinforcing doom loop.
It is a terrifying spiral, and we have seen it play out in dozens of nations over the last few decades. But then you have the alternative, presented by the authors, the stability cycle.
Hmm.
Let's trace how this one reacts to the exact same external shock.
An economic shock hits. Revenue drops. But this time, because the nation operates on viability budgeting, essential services are legally ring-fenced. The clinics stay open and fully staffed. The water purification runs uninterrupted. The strategic food buffers hold.
The floor holds.
Because those fundamental biological needs are reliably met despite the economic downturn, societal stress is significantly mitigated. People are concerned about the economy, yes, but they aren't panicking about their family's immediate physical survival.
That is a massive psychological difference.
It is the difference between a recession and a collapse. That reduced stress maintains public trust in institutions. That ongoing trust and societal predictability create a highly improved, stable investment climate.
So the investors stick around.
Capital either stays in the country or actually flows in, seeking a safe haven from volatility elsewhere. This sustained investment builds further infrastructure resilience, resulting in greater overall stability to weather the next shock. Stability compounds just as ruthlessly as fragility does.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it forces us to look at how we measure economic success globally. The metrics we use dictate the reality we build.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, our primary macroeconomic metrics are measuring the completely wrong things if our goal is human flourishing. We obsess over gross domestic product.
GDP.
But GDP just measures the total velocity of economic activity. It's completely blind to the health of the society.
That is a critical flaw. If a nation experiences a massive environmental disaster that requires billions of dollars in emergency cleanup and rebuild efforts, their GDP actually goes up. The disaster looks like economic growth on a traditional spreadsheet.
Which is wild to think about.
We look at sovereign bond spreads to measure global investor sentiment and national health. But neither GDP nor bond yields measure the heavy metal content of your drinking water. They don't measure the teacher-to-student ratio in your local school or how long a mother has to wait in an emergency room to get her child's fever checked.
A viability-centered society would measure national success so differently. We would measure service uptime. We would measure deferred maintenance backlogs.
If a municipality's water system uptime is 99.9%, if their primary care clinic wait times are under 20 minutes, and if their critical infrastructure maintenance backlog is sitting at zero, that society is deeply economically successful and incredibly stable, even if their GDP growth was relatively flat for that specific quarter.
The metrics must reflect the biological reality, not just the financial velocity.
Absolutely.
I want you to think about owning a car. Think about how much cheaper and how much less stressful it is to simply change the oil in your car every 5,000 miles. It's routine, it's boring, it costs a little bit of money up front.
Maintenance.
But if you decide to practice aggressive austerity on your car to save $50 this month, and you skip the oil changes for 2 years eventually, the engine completely seizes up. You blow the engine while driving on the highway, you are stranded in a dangerous situation, and it costs you thousands of dollars to replace the entire block.
And you still have to pay for an oil change eventually anyway.
Right. The paper coins a phrase for this that I absolutely adore, the quiet radicalism of maintenance. Maintenance isn't glamorous. No politician cuts a ribbon and poses for a photo op for replacing a rusty subterranean pipe that no voter can actually see.
It doesn't win modern elections.
And because it doesn't fit into a tidy, flashy campaign promise. But routine, unglamorous maintenance is the very thing that stabilizes civilizations.
The car analogy is perfect. We are constantly blowing the engine of our society because we refuse to pay for the oil change, pointing to a spreadsheet to justify our negligence. But diagnosing the problem and recognizing the elegance of the viability floor is only half the battle.
Right.
The logical next question for anyone reading this paper is, if this makes so much rational sense, how do we actually change the entrenched architecture of global finance? How do we scale this concept from a local town's water supply all the way up to international monetary policy?
Because a small town can boldly say, we are legally protecting our water budget, but they still exist within a volatile global economy. Sections 5 and 6 of the paper tackle this implementation challenge directly. They don't just leave it as an academic thought experiment. They lay out specific implementation pathways across three distinct levels: community, national, and global.
Let's start back at the community level. they introduce a concept called participatory viability mapping.
Participatory viability mapping. What does that look like?
It's a fascinating democratic tool. It essentially requires local governments to bypass the traditional consulting firms and go directly to their citizens, asking a very specific question. What system failures frighten you the most? Where do you feel the most vulnerable in your daily routine?
Asking the people on the ground.
Because the people living and working in a community know exactly where the hidden systemic risks are long before the municipal accountants see the data.
The delivery driver knows which roads flood first. The nurses know which clinics are dangerously understaffed on weekends.
Precisely. They know which power transformers spark during a summer storm. By mapping these specific localized vulnerabilities in partnership with the public, municipalities can act as testing laboratories.
They become innovation platforms.
They do. A city can pilot a viability budget for just its water and emergency services, proving over a five-year period that legally protecting those specific vulnerabilities actually saves the city money in crisis aversion and maintains social peace.
You prove the concept locally to build the political capital to scale it nationally. Which brings us to the national level, and this is where the mechanics get significantly more complex. Sovereign nations have to integrate these viability thresholds into actual constitutional or statutory law.
But there is a massive hurdle here that the paper highlights, especially for smaller or developing nations. They call it foreign exchange vulnerability, or FX. We need to spend some time here, because this is where the theory hits the hard wall of global trade.
This is arguably the most critical friction point for global implementation. Let's say you are a small island nation in the Caribbean, drawing on Dr. Saidly's background. Your government might have the most enlightened, perfectly structured viability budget in the world on paper. You have legally mandated that your hospitals and water plants will always be fully funded.
But your small nation likely does not domestically extract its own petroleum.
Exactly.
You don't manufacture your own complex pharmaceuticals. You don't produce the specialized chemical treatments required for your water purification plant.
You have to import those essential survival goods from the global market.
Yes. And to buy those critical goods on the global market, you cannot use your own local currency. You need foreign currency, almost exclusively U.S. dollars or euros. So how does a small nation get U.S. dollars?
Usually through exporting goods or through tourism.
Right. If a massive global shock happens, say another pandemic or a sudden spike in U.S. interest rates, your tourism industry might collapse overnight. Suddenly, your supply of foreign exchange completely dries up.
So even if your domestic budget says the hospital is fully funded in local currency, it doesn't matter.
Exactly. You can print all the local currency you want, but the global pharmaceutical company won't accept it. Suddenly, you physically cannot buy the diesel fuel to run the island's power plant, and you cannot buy the insulin for the hospital.
The floor falls out.
Your deeply planned viability floor collapses, not because of bad local budgeting or domestic austerity, but entirely because of foreign exchange dependence. You are structurally vulnerable to the monetary policy of a country thousands of miles away.
So if you are the finance minister of that small nation, how do you actually build resilience against that specific vulnerability? How do you shield your viability floor from FX shocks?
The paper argues that national governments must begin treating foreign exchange reserves not just as a macroeconomic balancing tool, but as a critical viability variable. A national viability strategy requires physically and financially building strategic buffer reserves.
Stockpiling.
This means stockpiling essential imports, fuel, basic medicines, water chemicals during good economic times, so you have a physical buffer if currency access dries up. It also means aggressively diversifying where you get your foreign currency and critically restructuring national debt so that you aren't forced to pay back historical loans in foreign currencies while your people lack basic imports.
You have to meticulously insulate the biological life support systems from the volatility of global currency markets.
Which perfectly transitions us to the global level of implementation. Because you simply cannot talk about sovereign debt, foreign exchange, and developing nations without talking about the heavyweights, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
The paper is uncompromisingly clear about the role historical conditional lending has played in actively enforcing structural violence around the world.
Historically, the playbook has been practically consistent. When a developing nation faces a severe debt or currency crisis, institutions like the IMF step in to provide emergency bailout loans. But these loans come with incredibly strict, non-negotiable conditions, often referred to as structural adjustment programs.
And those conditions almost universally demand extreme fiscal consolidation.
Which is just the polite institutional term for brutal austerity.
They act as the enforcers for the artificial constraints.
They do. They demand the sovereign country dramatically slash public spending, privatize state-owned assets like water utilities, and suppress domestic wages to ensure that the foreign creditors get paid back first.
Pushing them into the fragility cycle.
This forces the vulnerable country straight into that fragility cycle we discussed earlier. The poorest, most vulnerable citizens of that nation end up paying the price for the macroeconomic balancing act with their health, their stability, and often their lives.
But the white paper proposes a total radical flip of this script. What if the IMF and the World Bank completely inverted their mandate? What if they linked their debt restructuring and emergency loans to resilience investment instead of austerity?
It would completely rewrite global development. Imagine if the core condition for an IMF loan wasn't you must cut your public health budget by 20%, but rather you must legally guarantee and verify a protected expenditure floor for municipal water, primary education, and regional hospitals.
It would treat climate adaptation and foundational infrastructure not as discretionary luxury items to be cut when the math gets tight, but as non-negotiable survival infrastructure.
From a purely pragmatic standpoint, the authors argue this is actually better for the creditors anyway. If a global lender forces a coastal nation to defund its flood defenses and seawall maintenance to pay back a loan this year, and then a Category 5 hurricane wipes out the country's entire economic capacity next year, the lender isn't going to get paid back anyway.
That defaults.
The debt will default. Enforcing structural violence is incredibly short-sighted, even from a purely financial risk management perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Dead or destabilized populations cannot service debt.
Now, we have to talk about the elephant in the room here, power dynamics. Transition friction is very, very real. The system we have right now might be fragile and violent for the vast majority of the global population, but it works incredibly well for a highly specific, highly concentrated minority.
Asset holders.
Asset holders, financial intermediaries, massive external creditors. They actively, immensely benefit from the scarcity and debt dependence model. When money is structurally tight, the people who hold the capital have immense unchallengeable power over labor and governments. They aren't just going to voluntarily hand over that leverage because a beautifully written white paper makes a logical point about water pipes.
This raises an important question. How do we actually navigate that entrenched resistance? The financial sector has lobbied against far less radical reforms, but the authors of the paper are refreshingly pragmatic here. They explicitly state that the path forward is not through moral denunciation.
You do not change global finance simply by standing outside the World Bank and yelling that the system is evil or greedy.
Moral outrage doesn't rewrite algorithms.
Exactly.
You change the system through incremental, undeniable, data-backed proof of superior stability.
Proof before scale.
Yeah.
You have to outcompete the old model.
Yes. You aggressively pilot these viability floors in specific controlled sectors, like a single state's healthcare system or a nation's energy grid. You gather the hard data over a decade.
And then show the numbers.
You show the ruthless bond markets that a municipality that legally protects its water maintenance actually has significantly lower long-term liability, fewer catastrophic crisis expenditures, and higher social trust, making it a fundamentally safer, lower-risk investment.
You prove resilience is profitable.
You build the irrefutable data set that proves resilience is actually more profitable and stable in the long run than brittle, short-term austerity. You shift the underlying metrics slowly but persistently, outcompeting the fragility model with undeniably better results.
So what does this all mean? What does all this macroeconomic theory mean for you listening right now? We aren't drafting IMF policy today. We aren't managing municipal water grids or negotiating foreign exchange reserves. How does the average citizen, the person whose daily life is impacted by these artificial constraints, actually push for this kind of structural change?
The final sections of the paper focus heavily on public mobilization and the necessity of rewriting our cultural narrative.
It starts fundamentally with making the invisible visible. The broader public needs to connect the dots between the abstract, seemingly boring, invisible monetary architecture we've discussed and their highly visible, stressful, everyday lived reality.
That connection is key.
When the power grid fails during a freeze, when local housing becomes completely unaffordable, or when the clinic wait times stretch to 10 hours, people need to deeply understand that this isn't just bad luck. It isn't just a natural disaster or an unavoidable tragedy.
It is often the direct, mathematically predictable result of budget sequencing choices made by accountants and politicians years prior.
I think about this constantly when I read local news. People get understandably furious when the pothole doesn't get fixed for months, or when the local public school drops its arts and music programs. But the paper offers incredibly tactical advice here. Anger is not enough. Protests must evolve into proposals.
That is a vital strategic distinction. It is incredibly easy to march against austerity. It is easy to hold a sign that says, "Stop the cuts." But it is much harder and far more politically effective to march for a specific, legally binding, protected expenditure clause.
Having a real demand.
When a community coalition demands that their local city council implement a localized viability floor specifically for the water and emergency health systems, they are bringing a structural, actionable proposal to the table.
It changes the dynamic of the debate entirely. It is incredible. Yes, the rhetorical shift around the concept of fiscal discipline. Currently, if a politician stands up and proudly declares they are enforcing fiscal discipline, it almost universally means they are cutting social spending.
They are balancing the budget by actively starving the foundational infrastructure.
The paper argues we must forcefully, culturally redefine what discipline actually means in a modern society.
True discipline is protecting the biophysical systems that keep society stable, even when it is politically inconvenient. Maintaining your underground infrastructure when no one is looking is disciplined. Building physical buffer reserves for unpredictable global emergencies is disciplined.
And the opposite.
Purposely ignoring a rusting pipe or an understaffed hospital to make a quarterly spreadsheet look balanced is the exact opposite of discipline. It is reckless, dangerous negligence masquerading as responsibility.
It completely changes how you listen to political debates or read economic news. The next time a politician champions their fiscal discipline by proudly announcing cuts to a vital public service, it begs the question: are we actually bumping up against a physical limit of concrete labor and energy? Or are we just suffering from a profound lack of institutional imagination? Are they balancing the books, or are they destabilizing the foundation?
Ultimately, the paper suggests we are talking about moving an entire global culture from a deeply entrenched psychology of scarcity, where we fundamentally believe that zero-sum competition is the only way to survive, to a psychology of stewardship.
Stewardship over competition.
We must reach a point where we collectively understand that broad baseline resilience is the only true form of security. Biological systems that cannibalize their own life support structures to fuel short-term growth always collapse. Human societies governed by the exact same biophysical laws are no different.
We have covered an immense amount of ground today, moving from local clinics to global monetary policy. Let's do a quick recap to bring all these threads together. We started by asking if money is violent, and we explored how money itself is merely a coordination tool, but the way our current architecture has wired it to artificially gatekeep basic human survival causes profound, direct, structural, and cultural violence.
But it doesn't have to be this way.
By learning to clearly distinguish between real physical constraints and artificial accounting rules, we can consciously adopt a new sequence. Viability budgeting demands a new operating system. Life first, accounting second. You calculate and guarantee the biological survival floor, water, health, food, shelter, education unconditionally.
And by doing so, you don't destroy the economy.
You actually rewire the entire system for long-term economic peace, ending the destructive, self-defeating doom loop of austerity and crises. I want to thank you so much for coming on this deep journey with us today. I know macroeconomics and global monetary theory can feel incredibly dense, abstract, and at times intensely intimidating.
But understanding this invisible architecture is the absolute key to unlocking a less stressful, more resilient, and fundamentally more human world for all of us.
Now, before we sign off, I know we have a final thought to leave everyone with.
We do. I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building directly on where we started this conversation. We noted at the very top of the show that this groundbreaking paper was co-authored by a human medical doctor and an artificial intelligence, ChatGPT 5.2.
Right.
We spend so much of our cultural energy and our sci-fi narratives deeply worrying that AI will eventually become the ultimate ruthless enforcer of cold, calculated, algorithmic capitalism, that it will perfectly optimize us right out of existence for the sake of efficiency.
It's a huge fear.
But what if the exact opposite turns out to be true? What if it takes the massive, unbiased, global pattern recognition capabilities of an artificial intelligence to finally hold up a mirror to humanity and objectively say, I have analyzed your data. Your economic rules are just as artificial and just as constructed as I am. And unlike the immutable laws of biology and physics, you have the power to rewrite your code at any time.
Wow. What a profound and ultimately hopeful thought to end on. You have the power to rewrite the rules. Thank you for diving deep with us today. Keep questioning the invisible constraints around you. Keep looking for those artificial rules, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.